All right, we got up to slide six last time. All right, we got through five. We haven't looked at six yet. And what we're looking at in six is just a few possibilities, not all of the possibilities, but just a few of the possibilities for what happens to offspring when there is mating of parents, at least one of which has an allele for a genetically heritable disorder. Not all genetic disorders are heritable, like cancer, for instance, a genetic disorder, because it starts with damage to the DNA. That's genetic. But it's not heritable. It's not passed on. You don't inherit from parents. But some are. And what we're looking at here is an example of one that is not only genetically heritable disorder. It's a generic example. It's not a specific disorder, but it's not only heritable, but it is sex-linked, which is why the genotypes give not only the alleles, either upper end for normal or lower end for the one that can lead to the disorder, but they also include information about the sex chromosomes. And therefore, the Punnett squares, like we were talking about before with sex-linked genes, show not only the genotype with respect to the disorder, but they also show the sex of the offsprings. Anyway, in this scheme, the white background individuals are completely normal. They don't have the disorder, and they're not carrying an allele that can lead to it. Dark red is an affected individual, meaning that individual has the disorder, and halfway between that light red color means that person is a carrier. A carrier is a person who has the defective allele and therefore can pass it on to offspring. It's possible, but that person does not have the disorder, because it's a recessive disorder, and therefore the only way to have the recessive phenotype, which would be the disorder, would be to be homozygous. Carriers are heterozygous. All right, so anyway, in this case you have a completely normal female mating with an affected male. And what you see that happens in this case, or what the Punnett square shows you about those children, is that all of the females, which is the left half of the Punnett square, will be not have the disease, but they will be carriers. And all of the males will be totally normal. And this makes sense, right? Because to be a male, you have to have an X and a Y. Well, you have to get a Y from your father. Therefore, the X that you have has to come from your mother, and she was completely normal. In the middle case, we have a carrier female mating with a normal male. And in that case, as you see, half of the daughters will be totally normal, half will be carriers. Still, no daughter will have the disorder in that immediate family. Half of the boys will be completely normal, and half of them will be affected. And of these three, the worst possibility, I mean, the ones you're taking the most chance with, is if you have a carrier female mated with a male that has it. In that case, half of the daughters will be affected, half of the boys will be as well, but all of the females will at least be carrying it. Of course, even more risky than that would be if both parents were affected, and then it's 100%. All right. Let's go to seven. This is a slide that introduces the notion of dosage, genetic dosage. Now, when we use the word dosage, usually we're referring to how much someone gets, right? Like in medicinal terms. Well, dosage here refers to the number of alleles that an individual has for a characteristic. And here you need to think back to the difference between autosomal genes and sex-linked genes. For autosomal genes, a diploid organism is going to have two alleles, right? One on each of the two homologs. And that's true for both sexes, right? Sex, the gender doesn't matter for an autosomal gene. But for a sex-linked gene, whatever it is, and here we're assuming mammals in this example, so it could be humans, could be cats, whatever. But anyway, I say mammals because they use the XY system. If you're in the XY system, then that means the male has only one allele and the female has two, as we've already talked about. Well, that's where the word dosage comes from. In effect, for a sex-linked gene in the XY system, the male only has half a dose compared to the female, half a dose of alleles. The reason this can matter is because if you're a female and you therefore have two alleles for the gene, then in the same amount of time compared to a male, you can transcribe twice as many mRNAs because you have two genes to work with. And therefore, in the same amount of time, you can translate using those that double amount of mRNAs twice as many polypeptide copies compared to a male. And so for certain genes, species have evolved ways to level the playing field, so to speak, to make up for this dosage difference, which is why those mechanisms are called dosage compensation. And how this happens depends on the gene, depends on the species. But if you think about trying to accomplish this, there's really two major ways you could go about this. You could bring the male up to the level of the female somehow. And that could be, you know, you're not going to be able to add, you know, truly bring him up to the level of her, because that would mean giving him an extra allele somehow. That's not going to happen. But you can make his one gene easier to transcribe than hers by, you know, transcription factors that we were talking about earlier that are necessary for the transcription to occur. In other words, you can make the male's one gene easier to turn on than her two genes, and that could level the playing field. That's not what's happening here in this example, by the way, but that's one possibility. The other major way you could go about it, though, is to bring the female down to the level of the male. And that is what's happening here. In a specific kind of dosage compensation called X chromosome inactivation. And this is exactly what the phrase says it is. One of the two X chromosomes in a female is inactivated. So she, of course, starts out with two, but one of them early in her development, before she's born, before this cat was born, when she was not even a fetus, but later than zygote stage, when she was an early embryo in the womb of her mother, one of the two X chromosomes in each of her cells becomes inactivated, and the way it happens is that the chromatin of that one chosen, randomly chosen X chromosome becomes really super condensed, well beyond what it is in metaphase. It gets condensed to the point of being unusable for transcription. In other words, it's there, but it might as well not be there because none of its genes is going to be transcribed. All right? And that, of course, is going to bring her down to the level of the male, because even though she has two X chromosomes, she really has only one usable one, just like he does. All right? So that's how it accomplishes dosage compensation, but it has some interesting possible outcomes. Before we get to this outcome, though, imagine that you are a cat that is homozygous for this gene. The gene, by the way, here, the sex-linked gene that we're looking at, is one that is for coat color with possible alleles for orange fur or black fur. Well, if you are a female who is homozygous, and it doesn't matter whether it's homozygous either way. Homozygous with orange fur means you're going to be, it doesn't matter which X chromosome gets inactivated, right? You're going to leave the orange one, an orange one, and therefore you're going to be completely orange. And similarly, if you're homozygous for black, inactivation isn't going to change your phenotype, in other words. But here we have a heterozygous female. So one of her two X chromosomes has the color gene for black, and the other one has the color gene for orange. And there, it does matter which one you inactivate, because whichever one gets inactivated, you're not going to be that color, right? Well, it's not for the whole body, though, because of what I said just a little bit ago. Now, if this inactivation happened in the zygote, when she's just one cell, then it would be the whole body that's either completely orange or completely black, depending on which one of the X chromosomes in the zygote got inactivated. Because once inactivation happens, all of the cells that descend from that cell splitting will also have the same X chromosome inactivated in them. Right? But that's not how it happens, as I said. It happens later than the zygote stage, but still early in development. So in the early embryo, it doesn't look like a cat yet, but it's a ball of multiple cells, just like you were after your zygote. And each one randomly chooses an X chromosome or the other. Okay? Well, if you have a ball of hundreds of cells, but not nearly the billions or trillions of cells that the adult's going to be, then you're going to, just imagine a ball of cells, some of which are orange, some of which are black. The genes are there. I mean, you can imagine the cells being orange and black, though. Well, once that decision is made, once the inactivation occurs, then all of the cells that spring from that cell will have the same color. And that's going to correspond to a region in the body in the adult. The position of the cell in the ball of cells that make up the embryo are going to correspond spatially to a part of the body in the adult. And that's why it's not a completely even hair-by-hair red or blackness, which would make it look like it's all one color, basically. If you had alternating red and blacks, it would look like a reddish-black color, but solid. Instead, though, you have these splotches where you can have a kind of a big region, irregular region of orangeness, and then a big region of blackness. That's because all of those cells descended from a cell in the embryo that chose that direction. So that females, because of this, are called mosaics, which is a mixture of phenotypes, basically, at the surface. And there's an example for humans, even though it's not easy to tell by looking at a woman, like it is for this cat with coloration. Humans can be mosaic. Female humans can be mosaics with respect to the ability to freely sweat, because it's a sex-linked trait. And so you can't, like I said, you can't tell it unless you got very close up with a microscope and looked at the pores. But a heterozygous female will have patches that are able to freely sweat and others that aren't, for the same reason. Now, 8. This is a dihybrid cross. It starts out just like any other dihybrid cross we've talked about. So remember, the dihybrid cross is simultaneously concerned with two different characteristics. What are the characteristics here? Right, body color and wing shape. And for body color, there's two traits. For wing shape, there's two traits, as we expect in dihybrid crosses. The dominant color is gray, and the dominant wing shape is a full shape, full normal wing. The recessive traits are black body and vestigial wing, which is a very much reduced in size. Well, this uses this one of those multiple standards for genotypes that we had an example of before, where instead of using an initial for the dominant trait, we use an initial for the recessive trait. That's why B here for black is what's used, but when you put a plus on it instead, you're not black, you're gray. And VG stands for vestigial, the recessive color, but VG plus means actually normal winged. So this parent in the upper left is a doubly homozygous wild type, or dominant normal. Gray body and full wing. This one is a doubly recessive, doubly homozygous recessive individual, black body and vestigial wing. It shouldn't surprise you, because it's just another example of a dihybrid cross, that when you cross these two doubly homozygous individuals that differ in their traits, all of the F1s are going to have the same same genotype, right? Because you're going to get a B plus from one parent, a B from the other, a VG plus from the one parent, and a VG from the other. They're all going to be doubly heterozygous, just like for the P color and shape one that we looked at. That's this one represents all of the F1s. Well, then, what's different about this is that we're interested in testing hypotheses. So a test cross is performed on an F1, in this case it's a female. An F1 individual is then crossed with a doubly homozygous recessive male. Okay? Not the F1 with another F1 like before. But the reason we're doing this is to test the hypotheses. Well, let's look at the Punnett square, though. Notice it's only one row. We could have made it four rows and four columns, but all four rows would be identical. Because the sperm coming from this doubly homozygous recessive individual can only be one type, right, with respect to these two characteristics. It has to be a V, whichever one you want to choose. It has to be a VG, whichever one you want to choose. So he can only make one kind of sperm. She, on the other hand, is doubly heterozygous, so she can make four possible eggs, right? B plus VG plus, B plus VG, B VG plus, and B VG. All right, so it's an exhaustive listing of all the gametes, like a Punnett square should be. Now, these first two zygotes in the Punnett square, the left two, notice each one of those looks exactly like one parent or the other. In other words, it has the traits of one parent or the other. This one is just like that parent, this one's just like that parent. And therefore, we call these ones, collectively, parental types, because they're like one parent or the other. These ones don't look like either parent, because they have the trait for one characteristic from one parent, and the trait for the other characteristic from the other parent. This one is gray-bodied but vestigial-winged, this one is black-bodied but normal-winged. They're not like either parent, they're like a combination of the parent traits, so we call those recombinant types rather than parental types. Okay, now I can actually talk about these hypotheses that are being tested. One hypothesis is that the genes are linked. And I defined this, I think, earlier on, but let me remind you of the word linked, which is totally different from sex-linked. We've been talking about sex-linked quite a bit. And it makes sense to talk about one gene in isolation as being sex-linked or not, right? Because any given gene is either sex-linked or it's not. If it's not, it's autosomal. But it doesn't make sense to talk about a single gene as being linked. That doesn't make any sense. Because linked by itself, not sex-linked, linked refers to two genes, at least, that are on the same chromosome. That's all it means. Two genes are linked only if they are on the same type of chromosome. If they're on the two number threes or whatever. On the number threes or whatever. Okay, so this makes sense in this experiment because we are looking at two genes, right? A gene for color and a gene for wing shape. And the question, therefore, is, are these two genes linked or not? One of those has to be true. There's no other possibility. A pair of genes is either on the same chromosome or the two genes are on different types of chromosomes. So one of these has to be true. But that's this predicted ratios section says if genes are located on different chromosomes. That's just another way of saying if the genes are not linked. Okay? And if they're not linked, then the predicted ratio of phenotypes in the offspring is 1 to 1 to 1 to 1. Because if they're not linked, the genes can stay together or go to different gametes, since they're on different chromosomes. And therefore, you should be able to make all four of these possible zygotes. And they have equal chances, so the ratio should be 1 to 1 to 1 to 1. A quarter of however many you have should be each type. Does that make sense? Well, if the genes are located on the same chromosome, is another way of saying that they're linked. And if they are linked, then that's fundamentally different from not being linked, because genes do not operate in isolation, right? When it comes to meiosis, genes don't independently move in meiosis. They are passengers on chromosomes, and it's chromosomes that move. So if there are two genes that are linked, they're going to go together because they're on that same chromosome. And therefore, if these two genes in this example are linked, you would expect the ratio to be 1 to 1 to 0 to 0. In other words, you shouldn't expect it to be possible to have any recombinant types, because color and wing shape are going together. You can't mix and match. Okay? Now, those are the predicted ratios. 1 to 1 to 1 to 1, 1 to 1 to 0 to 0. Notice the real results, though. Neither one of these predictions came true, even though one of the hypotheses has to be true. Let's look at, you have close to 1,000 parental of one type, close to 1,000 of the other parental, and close to 200 each of the two recombinant types. So, the fact that this is a huge sample size, and you're not getting anywhere close to 1 to 1 to 1 to 1, which you should if they are truly unlinked, that suggests strongly that these two genes really are linked. Because if they're not linked, and you have this many offspring, that's like hitting the lotto 2 days in a row to get this much of a skewing in the difference from 1 to 1 to 1 to 1. So it's looking clearly like they are linked. But how is it that it's possible for two genes that are linked to still separate from each other and therefore make some recombinant types?
Through crossing over?
Exactly. That's the answer. If you imagine two genes being linked, yes, they're going to go wherever the chromosome does, unless in meiosis a chiasma forms between their two positions, their two loci. Because, remember, there's a swapping of the genetic material between the two non-sister chromatids that cross over. And what were together on one chromatid are now going to be on separate chromatids and go into different gametes. And we can see that effect in slide 9, where the chromosomes are shown here. This is the same exact cross. But the chromosomes are shown. Now, this is not the original individual. This is the F1, the double heterozygote, which is why you have B plus and B, BG plus and BG. But anyway, when these adults that are crossed replicate their chromosomes, then you have double the chromatids. But then when it comes to meiosis 1, that's when crossing over occurs. And where specifically?
Prophase 1,
yes. That's when synapsis occurs and crossing over, which involves this swapping. Now, the two black marks represent the two loci, a locus for gene body color and a locus for wing shape. But imagine that crossing over, which can occur anywhere, it's just random. Imagine if that chiasma, which is the point of crossover, occurred either at one end or the other, outside of the two loci. Doesn't matter which side, but not between them, anywhere except between them. Well, then it wouldn't matter, right? Because the swapping wouldn't separate these two still. They would still be together. So separation of two linked genes during meiosis requires crossing over to occur somewhere between the two loci. That's the only way they can be split. And if you think about this, you know, the two gene loci can be anywhere. But the closer they are to each other, in a sense, the more linked two genes are, the closer they are together, the more unlikely it is that a randomly occurring point of crossover is going to occur between them, because that space is going to be smaller and smaller. All right? And that's what is shown on the bottom here with this calculation called recombination frequency. Years ago, before we could just look at actual DNA routinely like we do now, it was there was a graduate student working in a genetics lab who figured out mathematically that the recombination frequency can give you an idea of how closely spaced two linked gene loci are, which was a big deal because, you know, it's part of gene mapping. Before you could actually go in and look at the DNA, it was important to try to figure out where, you know, once you have already figured out that two genes are on the same chromosome, which is work in itself, then the question is, well, where are they located on the gene? And this was an early attempt at that mathematically. The recombination frequency is simply a percentage representation of recombinants in the total. So the total number of recombinants, which is where the 391 comes from, divided by the total number of offspring, and expressed as a percentage, 17% in this case. Well, the lower that number is, the graduate student figured out, the closer together the two loci are, which is why it made it unlikely for recombinants to occur. And if the two loci are effectively at the two ends of the chromosome, then they are still technically linked, but they're going to look like they're not linked because just about any chiasma is going to form between them. And so in slide 10, we can see this using three genes. Like I said, this gene mapping technique using these frequencies is outdated now since we can just directly look at the DNA, but this gives you the idea of what I'm talking about. You have to do this a pair of genes at a time. So there's three genes here, the B gene, the CN gene, the VG gene. So you compare B and CN, you compare CN and VG, you compare B and VG, and you get recombination frequencies for all three. And since the one for B and VG is 17%, the others are only about half of that, it's reasonable to assume that this CN one must come between those two. And so it's a lot of work, but you do that over and over, adding more and more genes, and you can come up with a more complete gene map like we see in slide 11, where these numbers really are just relative numbers. The zero doesn't really mean anything. It just means this is the first gene. And then all these other numbers are distances relative to zero. All right. Now let's switch gears a bit and look at 12. We've learned meiosis. We've been talking about it quite a bit. And you know that in meiosis, there are two division events, so things separate twice in meiosis. What separates is different in the two parts of meiosis, but there's separation in each of the two major parts of meiosis, meiosis one and meiosis two. And another word for separation is disjunction, which is just the noun form of disjoin, which means separate. Disjunction is what normally happens. That's what we've studied. And usually it goes off without a hitch. The two things separate. In meiosis one, homologs separate from each other or disjoin properly. And each one goes to one cell, the other one goes to the other. Meiosis two, the chromatids disjoin. And it usually happens no problem. So disjunction is normal. But every now and then, for whatever reason, there's a mistake made. And that's called non-disjunction. A failure to disjoin. So the proper thing lines up in metaphase, but when it comes to anaphase, they fail, at least one of the chromosomes fails to undergo disjunction. That's non-disjunction. Now, here in this cartoon example, on the left side, what are we looking? What is the N of this cell?
Three.
No. What is N in general? What's the definition of N?
The shape and size of a chromosome.
Not the size. N is the number of different types of chromosomes that a species has. Yes, N is two here. The two types of chromosomes are small and big. And what's the ploidy?
Diploid,
as you would expect for meiosis, right? It doesn't make sense for a haploid cell to enter meiosis. Because it can't split its ploidy in half after it's already only having one of each. So at the end is two, and it's diploid because there are two of each of those two types. Okay, well, what you see here is that non-disjunction, which is just accidental, can happen in either meiosis one or meiosis two. Here it's happening in meiosis one. And also notice that the accident does not have to happen for all of the chromosome types. In this case, this one's separating just fine. But this tetrad, which was supposed to separate into two homologs, did not separate. And so that gives rise to these two daughter cells. And both of those have a problem. First, before I talk about the problem, let me say that a cell of any given species that has the normal, correct number of chromosomes is called euploid. EU, just like in eukaryotes, means true or good. Except here, instead of meaning true nucleus, it means true number of chromosomes. All right, so euploidy is the normal condition. Anything other than the normal condition, the normal number of chromosomes, is the opposite of euploid, which is aneuploid. Or the condition would be called aneuploidy. Okay? And when meiotic non-disjunction occurs in meiosis one, like on this left example, then both of the cells that result from meiosis one are going to be aneuploid. There are two ways to be aneuploid, two major ways. Aneuploid means you have the wrong number of chromosomes, right? There's two ways that can happen. You can have too few or too many. Both of them are aneuploid. And both of them have problems or can cause problems. Which way do you think would be more difficult to survive?
Having less.
Yes, having too few chromosomes is much worse. Because when you lack a chromosome type, that means you don't have any genes that are carried by that chromosome. And therefore, you can't make any of those proteins. It's almost impossible to survive that, right? Having too many, it can also be problematic, though, depending on the chromosome as to the severity of it. So aneuploidy causes problems, but the point here is, since this non-disjunction occurred in meiosis one, both of these intermediate cells are already aneuploid, and even if the second division goes off normally, you're still going to have all the gametes, all four gametes are already going to be still going to be aneuploid. Okay? On the other hand, on the right hand, we can see that if the first division goes off without a problem, then you make two normal cells. And then in just one of those, an accident occurs, and you have non-disjunction occurring in meiosis II. Well, that's going to affect these two gametes, but not these two, because these came from a normal intermediate cell. And the reason why non-disjunction is such a big deal on, as far as genetics is concerned, is because meiosis involves production of gametes, and therefore you're passing on that defect. Whereas if you had non-disjunction in mitosis, it's just affecting that cell, right? Not affecting a generation. Well, speaking of accidents that happen, slide 13 shows you a sampling of possible chromosomal mutations. These are all mutations because mutations, by definition, are changes to DNA sequences. These all affect DNA sequence. But these are much wider scale or larger scale mutations than the ones we looked at earlier, which were point mutations, the ones we already studied. Point mutations affect just a single nucleotide pair or very small number of nucleotides. And so if you think about it as happening to genes, which it does, you know, first of all, there's a lot of, most of your DNA is between genes. So a randomly occurring mutation is probably not even going to affect a gene because it's somewhere between them. But even if it does just luckily happen inside a gene, it's only affecting that one gene, right? Just a tiny part of the gene, really. But all the other genes are unaffected. Well, here we're looking at whole regions of a chromosome being affected, which is what the letters represent, A, B, C, and so on. Those are not genes. Those are long stretches of chromosome length. So A contains many genes, B contains many genes, and so on. Okay? That's why these are called chromosomal mutations. Well, deletion is what you're already familiar with. Something gets removed. In this case, section D gets removed, and however many genes are in there are gone. That's a big deal, right? You don't, it's not quite as bad as not having the whole chromosome, but it might be just as fatal because those genes are important that are missing. Duplication refers to some section being copied. The original one is still there, but now a new version, a new copy is next to it. So ABCD becomes ABCBCD. And this actually is fairly survivable, and there's evidence that it happens pretty often. Which kind of makes sense, right? Because you haven't lost any genes. And also, it appears that it kind of makes for a evolutionary playground or laboratory, in a sense, for mutation to, or for natural selection to just run wild in the duplicated version, because it doesn't matter. Those are extra genes, right? If something happens to them, you still have the originals. And that might be what happens quite a bit in genomes and in species in general. Inversion refers to flipping around. So A, B, C, D, E becomes A, D, C, B, E. Notice here that nothing is added, nothing is lost. But the arrangement of the genes in the chromosome is different. There's a couple reasons why this could be a big deal. First of all, notice that the cuts, wherever they occur, the lines between A and B, for instance, and D and E, if those happen to be in the middle of genes, then you've ruined those genes. That's one reason it can be bad. But also, even if they don't occur in genes, and all the genes are still intact as far as sequence is concerned, they're now in a different place. And that can mess with the ability of the cell to control whether they're expressed or not, to turn them on and off appropriately. The most complicated one down on D is reciprocal translocation. It's more complicated because this involves two different types of chromosomes. So the AB section of one chromosome type and the MNO of the other type both break off, but then they get swapped for each other and put onto the wrong chromosome. Once again, you haven't added or gained anything. You might have destroyed some genes at the cut marks, just like in inversion. But you've certainly messed with the positioning of the genes and therefore the control of them, because these genes are no longer even on the correct chromosome at this point. It can cause problems. And 14 is just one human example of a reciprocal translocation that can cause problems. This doesn't happen too often, but more often than you might think. Chromosome 9 and 22 pieces break off and get swapped, leading to what's called a Philadelphia chromosome, which is one of several ways to get leukemia. It can lead to leukemia. Well, that brings us to 15, the final slide for the term. And the theme in this is what is called genomic imprinting. And I'm not going to get bogged down in the details of this, because the main reason I introduced this is that it's the only example that I'm giving you, because we haven't talked about this before, of an epigenetic process. Epigenetic, linguistically, means on the genes, just like epidermis means on the dermis. An epigenetic process is something that can affect phenotype without actually changing the genes, the gene sequence, the DNA itself. Well, I shouldn't say the DNA isn't changed. The DNA sequence isn't changed. So the nucleotides are still there in the same sequence, but something else is happening. And in genomic imprinting, what happens is that a single gene is turned off for the lifetime of that individual, but just on one of the two homologous chromosomes. This is a little bit like X chromosome inactivation, except it's not inactivating an entire chromosome. It's inactivating just one allele. The other allele on the other homolog is still functional. And the result of this is that the offspring is going to receive from its parents two chromosomes that carry that gene, as you'd expect. But one of those chromosomes is going to have that gene turned off, depending on the parent, and the other one's going to be turned on for its whole lifetime. On the top here, we have a homozygous individual mouse where the gene involved is one that controls body size. He's a normal-sized mouse because he's a homozygous individual, got two normal alleles from his parents, which, of course, you would expect to make him normal. But with genomic imprinting, he's really only using one of those, because in this case, the maternal chromosome gene gets turned off. That's the imprinting aspect. And therefore, the only one that's not turned off is the one that he gets the phenotype from, which is normal, of course, for a homozygous. But when you have a heterozygous mouse, there's two possible ways to be heterozygous, right? You can get the dominant from your mother, the recessive from your father, or the dominant from your father, the recessive from your mother. And in this particular example, which depends on gene by gene and species by species basis, but in this example, it's the maternal gene that gets deactivated by imprinting. So if you are a heterozygous that got the normal allele from your father and the mutant allele from your mother, well, that mutant allele might as well not be there because it's turned off, and therefore you will be normal size. But if it's the other way around and you got the mutant allele from your father, which is the one that stays turned on, and the normal one gets turned off from your mother, then you're going to be a dwarf size. Notice that these two can be genetically identical, but they're phenotypically different because epigenetics changes phenotype without actually changing DNA sequence. That's the main point. Any questions on that? Well, in that case, you are armed with all the knowledge to get 100% on exam 5. I needed just to say two quick things. One is that it's really important, if you haven't already, to make sure that you carefully read the announcement I made a week and a half ago or so. And specifically, I need everyone to realize that if you come in on... this is another big thing. When is the exam? 11 o'clock, not 11:30. Okay? On when? Tuesday 11. That's when you need to be here. But if you come in 11 on Tuesday and you accept the exam from my hands, like you do every time, at that instant you no longer are allowed to withdraw. You can withdraw up to then, but not if you do the last thing, not if you even look at the test. So make sure you understand that. And just bring a Scantron as usual. Enjoy the weekend.